I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Hot sardines might not be everybody's cup of tea when snack time rolls around, but the tunes by a music group of the same name are quite a bit more palatable. Today we hear from a jazz band that can have you tapping your toes with one song and feeling blue with the next. Band members join us from the road to preview their show at the Folly. But first, what happens when young women are pressured to be just fine when they're not? We'll learn how health issues can impact work, relationships, even the way women view themselves. Later, Brian McTavish joins us once again with his weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news.
We're gonna have a party, invite all our friends, drink and pretend life's grand, everything is dandy. Pinkies raised, we'll toast the days coming to an end. My friend, it's time for French fries and champagne. Yesterday was easy, breezing through the years. No cares and no fears. You and I, the world, our briny oyster. Let's not get sentimental. We'll tango through the tears. So cheers, time for French fries and champagne.
One critic described the sound of the Hot Sardines as the charismatic frontrunners of vintage jazz who play big halls as if they just dropped into a party. Think of them as ushering a return to the hot jazz and swing sounds of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. It's a sound akin to Louis Armstrong's Hot 5 and Hot 7, Fats Waller, Django Reinhardt, Billie Holiday, and the Andrews Sisters. There's no group quite like them, and they'll be in Kansas City this weekend to play the Folly Theater as part of the theater's ongoing jazz series. Joining us now are the two leaders of this group, Evan Palazzo. And Evan, welcome back to the show. Nice to have you.
Oh, thanks so much. It's great to be back.
Vocalist Elizabeth Bougeral is also with us. Elizabeth, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Do the two of you like that description of your sound, that you had just dropped into a party, Elizabeth?
Oh, I love it. I think it's great.
I do, too.
I mean, what's really exciting is, especially with a room as big as the Folly, that's the challenge, right, is to make everyone feel like you just found the greatest house party of all time.
And Evan, why that sound? Why is that the sound you want to disseminate here?
Well, Elizabeth and I share in common a love of this music, and it goes back to our early childhood, I suppose, what we were each exposed to. But to our great joy, it's really something that I think in these times people respond to well, because it's joyous, it's a party, it's swing your dance partner, and there's great lyrics and wonderful rhythms. So we love all that stuff, and we put it together in every form we can think of.
And honestly, it's music that brings people together. And some eras need live music more than others, I think. And I think what's really cool is seeing audience members who might have nothing in common all coming together into a room and sinking into the feeling of recognizing tunes maybe their grandma sang, but
right.
At the same time we're definitively playing those in the 21st century, and so it's important to have something for everyone in the room. And it does. I really do think that live hot jazz brings people together.
Hey, Evan, this music goes back to your childhood, you just said.
Well, when I was first exposed to it was as a tiny child, and I spoke to me immediately, and I immediately wanted to hear more and to play it, actually. And that's how I got into music, is through this love of this particular style of music. And when I was growing up, that was not necessarily the most popular thing to do. But
what, listening to like 20s and 30s jazz didn't make you super hip in the 80s and 90s? I'm so surprised.
Hey, Evan, can you play Thriller? Can you play Dire Straits? No, I got this Fats Waller number I'm working up, though, and I'll do it. But lo and behold, in the mid-aughts, I guess, till late aughts, there was this, right as Elizabeth and I met and were noodling around on our common love of this music, a lot of younger musicians coming out of the conservatories really were digging into it. So for the first time, like, there was this great nexus where New York had a new vibrancy in approaching this music, and that's how we kind of got started.
You know, the two of you met at an open jazz jam in New York City that was advertised in a Craigslist ad.
Yes.
I mean, really, Elizabeth?
Yeah, really, really, really. I was actually working as a travel editor for AOL at the time. And my holiday party was that night. And I knew about this jazz jam. I'd seen this Craigslist ad. And I like went to the open bar at my corporate party and downed a couple of shots and just, you know, gathered up all my gumption and went to this thing. And, you know, there were maybe like eight people there, and we played a whole bunch of old tunes, you know, Summertime and I Can't Give You Anything But Love and stuff like that. And I went up to Evan afterwards because I really loved his playing from the first note. I felt he was such an old soul and had a style that I really loved. And we connected and we just kind of started, you know, messing around with no idea beyond having this as a hobby.
I think it was not an intent to have this wonderful career we're enjoying and so lucky to have.
But you know, we were excited to, I think, find one other person to work on this music with, and we started adding musicians and going to open mics and it just really just kind of happened.
I mean, that's just an amazing story. I mean, you know, of course, so much of life is serendipity, and here you two are living serendipity every single day.
It's true. I mean, I'm not, no doubt when we realized how much we were enjoying it, and I think how much we clicked musically and the songs started to click, we really put our heart and soul and a lot of effort into it. So, you know, as with anyone who picks up a hobby that eventually turns into a career, everything starts, all the pistons start firing, but it really was never anything we intended. And it's so exciting to go across the country and now the world and find that people are into this music that I always thought, like, oh, no, I'm the only one who listens to this. My mom is the only one who listens to this. My grandma's record collection is the only place I will ever hear this stuff. But
you know, Evan, what is it about this music? I mean, there's something friendly, comforting, warm. You know, what is it that drew you to it and continues to draw you to it?
Oh, it's the joy. It's the fun. It's a certain kind of fun. It's an care and abandonment fun without being embarrassed about having care and abandonment. And while a lot of shows that one would see today, rock and roll shows, have a lot of care and abandonment, it's not necessarily in this specific zone of joyousness. You know, it's sort of like, have a drink, have a dance, your girlfriend or boyfriend is looking mighty fine and dapper, and we might just cut a rug. Right here in the Isle of the Folly, we would hope.
I also think, you know, it's cool to I think a lot of people have never heard this music live. They've maybe heard it, you know, through their grandparents' record collection or their great grandparents' record collection, or they've like heard it on a movie soundtrack, you know, some sort of scratchy 78 record, and they have a general concept of this stuff. But to hear it live is really special. To see a brass section improvising live is incredibly special. To watch Evan's hands flying across the keys in a style called stride that doesn't really happen much anymore.
Right.
You just don't see that much a lot. And you're watching eight musicians largely improvising on stage. And there's a real seed of connection in it, and I still can't explain it. And if anyone figures it out, please drop us an email. But we can't figure it out.
It's also,
but it feeds us. It makes us kind of levitate a little bit.
And it motivates us. That feeling you get, it motivates us to do the very difficult work that we all do, to listen to each other, to constantly be dedicated to the music we're playing and communicating that to the audience. And Elizabeth's vocals, as she sings in French and English, and the lyrics that we get to cover and she gets to sing are some of the greatest lyrics I think ever written for music. And And people also don't get to hear that very often.
The Hot Sardines play the Folly Theater on Friday night at 8 o'clock. Tickets, follytheater.org. Evan, do you guys mix it up every single night?
We do like to have a loose set list, but things change. When we get in the space, you know, it's always about how the audience and the room and us work together.
But even the improvising that goes on in every song, if I hear you one night, is it different the next?
Yes, they'll be different. Absolutely. We have a skeleton plan, and in the great tradition of early jazz, the band leader calls solos, and I actually use baseball signals to do so, which people enjoy watching. But most of the time, people are listening to each other, and if something starts to go in a certain direction, we're ready to go with it. It's a high wire act.
It's like watching figure skating at the Olympics. You never know who's going to land the triple Sacow and who isn't.
Triple Lutz. Well, we also, of course, have our tap dancer, which is an added visual depiction of the amazing energy of this music.
Fun.
But it keeps you all sharp, right? Because you can't just you can't just do the same thing you did every night.
You got to be on it, and that's why when we started playing this music, it was a pleasure that there were a growing number of new musicians who were able to dedicate themselves to play this style in that way and to be on it, because it's difficult.
Were they hard to find, the other six members of the group?
Over the years, we've gotten to play with so many amazing musicians. The six that we are with now, we have found through various sources, recommendations, having seen them live, and we're lucky to say that there's a nice pool of talented, amazing young musicians and musicians who've been playing for a few years now who really, really dedicate themselves to playing this music.
And they're excited to jump into the idea of making something from 100 years ago feel fresh today. It's really cool.
That's the key. You see, we're playing for an audience in 2018 in our mind, so it's not a trip back in time type feel for us.
Well, let's listen to some more music from the Hot Sardines. This is Until the Real Thing Comes Along. This is from their 2016 album, their latest. We're waiting for some new music, French Fries and Champagne. Again, this is the Hot Sardines.
I'd work for you, slave for you, be a beggar or a knave for you. If that isn't love, it'll have to do. Until the real thing comes along, I'd gladly move the earth for you to prove my love and its worth to you. If that isn't love, it'll have to do. Until the real thing comes along, with all the words at my command, I can't seem to make you understand. I'll always love you, come what may. My heart is yours, what more can I say?
That's the Hot Sardines. Elizabeth, help me here. You are a London School of Economics educated one-time travel writer. You've referred to the travel writer part here. How did you wind up with a career as a professional musician?
Well, Mick Jagger also went to the London School of Economics, and he's doing pretty well for himself.
There you go. Yeah. What was your journey, though?
I mean, so many things just hinge on a little nothing, right? I think that I'd always loved this music. I sang in the shower, taught myself to sing, worked on it behind closed doors. I always thought that there were normal people walking around down here, and then musicians were kind of on this elevated plane. Never occurred to me to make a real stab at it. But But as Evan was describing earlier, you know, living in New York City, we're so spoiled by having so many great places to go and hear music. And I was working as a travel writer in a cubicle, and I would go hear a lot of music. And I was just getting inspired. And I think over on the other side of town, Evan was kind of coming to his same realization that he wanted to do something with it.
Yeah.
And I think that happens to a lot of people where they have the passion for something, they have the instinct to do something with it, but maybe they never just, you know, have that moment where something clicks. And I think one of the things that's been so cool about the whole Craigslist ad thing is, I know for my part, I was just kind of looking for one or two other people who would, you know, who wanted to mess around on this music, and I found that, and it's been great. And you know, this was right around the time of 2008, you know, and it was not lost on us that we were having fun playing music from the last Great Depression. And so, you know, maybe that was part of it too, is just like people wanted to go out and have fun. And if you pull up some of those grainy old YouTube clips of like Louis Armstrong or early Ray Charles, you know, there's a vibe in there that, you know, people, it's a little, you know, make me forget my troubles.
Right.
There's a little element of that. While at the same time being, it's such an exciting thing to tackle these songs that have survived for so long and to have the, you know, to listen to everything that jazz and popular song has given us.
You know, Evan, you came at this through the theater world. You began playing piano at age 3, but what got you going on stride piano? Because again, such a throwback.
Well, I always loved Fats Waller and James P. Johnson and some of those guys, and that was that early music I heard, and I got very interested in how that rhythm works and wanted to imitate it. So I approached my piano music, which also, like Elizabeth, I was a self-taught, mostly pianist that played this music because I loved it, behind closed doors for the most part, until right really before I met her. And always loved performing, but never dreamed it would be doing this. This was sort of like my personal therapy, was to sit down, which I would do for sometimes hours a day, and just noodle around on what pleased me. And it's been to my great benefit, I think, that those maybe 25 years of doing that, I draw on every single day now. And I had no idea at the time that they would have any purpose beyond what I was doing. But if you do what you love, and this is what I always tell young musicians or anyone who asks, you know, I say what you have to do is do what you love, and things find a way.
You're not going to know
what it is, but you just do what you love. Keep working hard at that.
Evan, give me a sense here that the degree of difficulty when it comes to playing stride piano compared to more traditional jazz piano, is it tougher?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's funny because I think it's a very difficult style to play, but I think all music is difficult. There's the technique of it, which each style has its own, and stride particularly has a difficult technique because it's based off the 10th for you music nerds out there. Notes, and you gotta reach 10 notes.
Yeah.
But all music, I think the hard work and the real challenge is in the dynamics, the expressiveness, how you play it once you do know how to do the mechanics of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that fully answers your question. Stride is hard. Modern jazz is very difficult to play in a totally different way.
Right.
It's that. It's striking that balance between technique and abandon, right?
Right. Oh, yeah.
It goes back to the high wire act.
Right.
People
mm-hmm.
want to, you got to have the technique to do it, but you also then have to be able to be in the moment and follow an idea, a musical idea, and see where it leads you and be in the emotion of the song, because without the emotion of the song, this music doesn't work.
Elizabeth,
there's no point to it.
It's rhythmic and it's emotional.
I'm just struck by the fact that you guys have played the London Jazz Festival, Boston mm-hmm. Symphony Hall, and then you're touring the Midwest in the dead of winter. At times, this has got to feel, Elizabeth, a little surreal, doesn't it?
It all feels completely surreal. It feels totally surreal. Just the fact that I get to go to work with musicians who are, you know, at the top of their game, and then that people come out to see us is totally bananas to me. But again, I come back. I think people need. There's something about a live performance that people really need and crave right now. And I think there may be something to that. We're certainly having a ball, though. We never thought we would be here, and it's just been the greatest adventure.
Well, we're going to listen to some more music from the Hot Sardines. This last track, Running Wild from French Fries and Champagne, their latest album. Evan, when's the next album coming?
Oh, so good you ask.
Yes, as a matter of fact.
As soon as we get back from this little tour, we're fully delving into what we're hoping is going to be our next album, live album.
Oh,
which
really?
Which we should be looking for coming up at some point, maybe this early summer area,
okay,
if all goes as we hope. So, yeah, stay tuned for that. New music coming.
Evan Palazzo, Elizabeth Bourgerol, appreciate you both taking some time with us. The Hot Sardines play the Folly Theater, 8 o'clock Friday night. Tickets, follytheater.org. Thanks for your time, guys. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you so much. We can't wait to be back.
Running wild, lost control. Running wild, mighty bold. Feeling gay, reckless too. Carefree mind all the time, never blue. Always going, don't know where. Always showing I don't care. Don't love nobody, it's not worthwhile. All alone, I'm running wild.
And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we learned what convictions can be expunged from a criminal record and what requirements a person has to meet to make it happen. You can find that conversation and others at kcur.org/uptodate. Well, what happens when you're too young to be sick? Well, for some young women, they become isolated and out of step with their peers. Turns out that young women disproportionately live with chronic illness. The result, the idea of remaining youthful and carefree can sometimes get tossed out the window. Michelle Lent Hirsch writes about all this in a new book that's part memoir and part cultural inspection. The book, Invisible, How Young Women with Serious Health Issues Navigate Work, Relationships, and the Pressure to Seem Just Fine. And she joins us now from NPR in New York. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
Well, what are the specific obstacles in front of young women with serious health issues?
You know, there are so many that I wrote a whole book, but I think...
Read the book, Knucklehead,
yes.
Yeah.
No, I think one of the things I've really found, I interviewed women from across the country from all different walks of life who the one thing in common is we all identify as women and we all have gone through some health issue, some more chronic, some more acute. And I think one of the major things that I've found is that, you know, it's hard to be a young woman no matter what. The odds are stacked against you in terms of your career, equal pay. Obviously, right now, there's a lot of talk about something that's been happening for millennia, which is, you know, sexual assault. There's so much going on that you already have to deal with, the expectation to be beautiful, perfect. And that all is made so much harder when you are dealing with something that society has taught you does not happen to young people, and especially not, you know, a pretty young woman or a vibrant, quote unquote, young woman. All these phrases that people have said to me, there's no way you're sick. Look at you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the main things that can be hard.
And that's one of the issues, right? Because no one believes you. And then, you know, that impacts you at work, impacts your social relationships. And you're struggling to communicate with a buddy while in the back of your mind you're thinking you feel awful, you know?
Yeah. One of the chapters in the book most certainly explores career because, again, you know, there's already the glass ceiling and it's made a lot harder when you're navigating something unexpected and difficult or a disability you've had for a long time that perhaps your employer does not accommodate.
Right.
But friendship, as you just sort of pointed out, plays a big role in the book because so many young women who I spoke to said that, you know, even their best friends couldn't relate when they were going through something hard. And You know, at an age when you're, let's say, 20 or 30, when you really rely a lot on friends, it's really hard when you're experiencing something that your friends assume won't happen to anyone
right.
for another 20 or 30 years.
Michelle, I mentioned in the opening that this book is part memoir, and mm-hmm. you've been pretty open about the health struggles you faced in your 20s, and you had your hands full.
Yes.
What happened, and how did that lead you to this book?
Yeah, well, it is quite a laundry list. I was...
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, it really is almost funny. I was one of those kids who never got sick. My pediatrician, when I was small, used to lead me around to the other doctors in his office and say, "This is my healthiest patient."
Wow.
And he would say it with pride, which is something I think is worth noting, because that sort of is part of our cultural norm, where we expect someone to be proud of their health as if it's something that they've achieved or had control over. In fact, my doctor and I both had no control over the fact that I happened to not get strep throat, you know. So I went from being someone who was really touted for my health to suddenly having a number of things happen very swiftly. So I had hip surgery in college, and that really was out of nowhere. I'd been running every day for a lot of my life, and suddenly my hip was very, very messed up, and I needed surgery. And then just about a year or two after that, I suddenly had an anaphylactic episode, the kind of thing we usually hear about with, let's say, a severe peanut allergy.
Right.
And I was taken to the emergency room by a coworker and came very close to dying. And it happened a few more times, including the next day in India. I went to India, and the next week, I'm sorry, it happened on a train. And luckily, you know, my friend spoke the local dialect a bit from her grandmother and got us off the train and to an emergency room. So I've nearly died in a few countries. but that happened, and it took months and months to figure out what it was. And it ended up being something called mast cell activation syndrome, which is a somewhat rare condition that basically sends you into anaphylactic shock without any sort of food trigger.
Wow.
And
wow.
Yeah, so...
scary. Yeah.
Very, very scary, to say the least.
If you don't know when it's going to happen, like, if you know, if you have a peanut allergy, you eat a peanut,
right.
you got a problem. But in your case, this could happen at any time, right?
Yeah. Any time. And I, you know, was closely monitored, and I take antihistamines every day prophylactically, and I carry EpiPens. But it is a very, very scary, very life-threatening thing that can happen very quickly. And I thought, okay, this is enough already. You know, I've almost died. I'm only 22. I already had hip surgery a few years ago. This is enough already. Until a few years later, when I actually was diagnosed with thyroid cancer. And it's at that point, you know, you laughed, and I don't mind, because it is almost comical.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in there, I had another hip surgery, and then later was diagnosed with Lyme disease. And I thought, this is really making up for my childhood.
I was going to say. Well, you know, you described all these different maladies that you've been through. So why do you think some people are so uncomfortable with, you know, acknowledging a younger person's health issues?
That's a good question. I think there's a couple of reasons. I think that we obviously live in a world where many people, especially in this country, really don't want to think about aging or death. And many people don't want to think about anyone getting sick, right? They don't want to hear about their friend's grandmother getting sick, even, because it reminds them of their own mortality. But I think that when it's a young person, especially a young woman, we think of that person as sort of at their peak, or, you know, the poster child of health, or just starting out, all these cliches.
If they're sick now, what are they going to be like in 10 years? Yeah.
Right. And also, I think it just doesn't jive with what we imagine as like an archetypal, you know, young person. And I think for women especially, we are forced to carry, you know, these ideas of beauty and, you know, for some of us, fertility, and suddenly we're we're showing people actually we aren't any of those things. And I think it just makes people, you know, feel less secure about their own lives, and sort of it disturbs their idea of the order of things. Now, as you said in your introduction, young women are actually a huge percentage for a lot of diseases of who gets them. A lot of autoimmune diseases strike young women in particular. There are some cancers that especially strike young women.
I didn't know any of that until I looked at your book. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's exactly it, right? As we all sort of think, oh, that doesn't happen to young women. And in fact, it does. And so there's this disconnect between what we expect, what we see on TV, and what is actually happening in many, many people's lives.
Michelle Lent Hirsch is my guest. Her new book, Invisible, How Young Women with Serious Health Issues Navigate Work, Relationships, and the Pressure to Seem Just Fine. Let's turn to the relationships in your subtitle there, because as you point out, dating becomes more difficult for young women with health issues. Walk us through that.
Yeah, so I actually opened the book with a long section on dating and relationships, because what I found is that a lot of young women who already, again, whether we have health issues or not, we're already expected to be airbrushed looking and perfect and a very particular type, right? Like young, white, thin women are what, you know, predominantly we see on TV and in ads. I think that goes without saying at this point that that's a problem. But I think that when it comes to dating and sex and relationships, a lot of these ideas about how we should look, you know, or how we should behave, really come to the fore, because suddenly someone else is judging us, and suddenly we're thrust into a situation where we're thinking, you know, in my case, when I was in my early 20s, you know, I wish I had more self-esteem. I wish that I could just be really self-empowered. Mm-hmm. I wish I sounded like Oprah. But in fact, you know, unfortunately, I'm worried about what this guy thinks of me. And one thing that I explore in the book is the issue of sort of dating men versus dating women or people who are non-binary. In my case, I thought I was straight for most of my life and dated men through all of those health issues I told you about. I had boyfriends, dated men, that's all that happened. And it was only a few years ago that I actually came out and realized I was gay. And seeing the difference was very striking to me. And so I made sure to ask, you know, other people, what has been your experience? Because it's not that dating women as a woman gets rid of all these issues, right? You might still be very nervous that someone doesn't think you're pretty or doesn't think you measure up. But there is a bit of a difference when, you know, the male gaze, as we all like to talk about, right, is taken out of the picture.
And you point out that this notion of rejection is always hovering over your right shoulder the whole time.
Yes, and that is something that I think is important to point out, that even if you are dating someone who's wonderful and nothing has happened that makes you think, oh, they're judging me because I have, you know, diabetes or something, we've seen in movies, we've seen in books, we've heard through, you know, other people's stories that's sort of the threat, is that this person is going to leave you when he gets sick of your sickness. And I chronicle in the book some pretty horrible stories that I've gathered from, you know, interviews that I've done, where, you know, a man was kissing one of the women who I interviewed and decided midway through kissing her to physically push her away and say, I can't handle it, because she had MS, which in that moment, I mean, they were just kissing. It wasn't really an issue.
A painful story, yes.
Very painful. And another story where a man was very, very supposedly in love with his fiance and broke it off because she was sick. And, you know, you hear these stories, and again, they fit into what we've learned, right? Which is that women have to be perfect. And we have a very strict idea of what we think perfect means in this culture.
And along these lines, heterosexual marriages are almost 6 times more likely to end when the wife is sick, just to your point. I mean, that's a staggering number.
Yeah, and in the book, I cite a few different studies you might have seen, and, you know, statistics and studies are very, very difficult to take without a grain of salt because science is not perfect. You know, there's bias in studies. Sometimes it's hard to replicate something. If you're doing a health study, if you're doing this kind of survey, sometimes there's a flaw. So I've seen numbers up to 10 times. I've seen 6 or 7. But the bottom line is that in heterosexual relationships, if the man gets sick, there does not seem to be any uptick in divorce or separation. And if the woman gets sick, there most certainly is.
Motherhood is another topic that often comes up here. Some women with illness also face, fertility issues, and many of them have to consider whether to freeze their eggs. What are some of the obstacles there?
Yeah, so in the book, I explore various women's stories, some of whom absolutely want children no matter what. They will do pretty much anything they can to make sure that they can have biological children, even though they have, let's say, cancer or a surgery that's going to remove their ovaries in a few years or, you know, an autoimmune disease that makes it difficult. There's other women in the book I interview who don't want children and sort of, in a way, are informed by the fact that their bodies are already going through a lot. I also, you know, in the book, I interview women who are both cisgender and transgender. And there's one woman I interview in the book who's trans, and she says, you know, I can't carry a child. I don't have a uterus. But my wife happens to actually also have a chronic illness. And so, you know, both of us are not going to be able to do it. And we do want kids and we're going to look into adoption. But, you know, this woman said she has bipolar disorder and she knows that she will be facing some prejudice in the adoption system. So there's a lot of different stories that I've gathered that, you know, just point to the fact again that having an illness at a young age can really throw a wrench into things that are that can already be a very difficult, you know, thing to deal with. Like, am I going to get pregnant? Am I going to adopt? And it just becomes a lot harder.
Just finally, let's talk a little bit about work. I've got like 30 seconds here. What can employers do to support their employees who have disabilities? Because you have some horror stories in this book about bosses not getting it when it comes to young women and their health issues.
That's a great question. You know, one thing is that there is the Americans with Disabilities Act, but it is not always enforced and it does not seem to really exist in a lot of workplaces. And that is something that, you know, I think as a country, we really need to look at more. I know that right now people are trying to gut actually the ADA. And the fact is that already, even as it stands, it's often not enforced. The other thing is that there are a lot of workplaces that I think could learn a thing or two by talking to, you know, anyone, but especially young people with health issues, because not every health issue does fall under, you know, the ADA. But there are many workplaces where I think capitalism comes first and humans come second.
Yep.
And I think that having gone through so many health issues as a young journalist, a very difficult, as you know, career to make it, you know, to make it in, it can really be horrible when you feel that your boss is going to fire you if you don't stay five hours extra because you need to make up for the one doctor's appointment that she's suspicious of because she doesn't think you look sick.
Absolutely.
And so I think we need to have sort of a national awareness more of the fact that different bodies are different. And just because someone looks young and what you think of as pretty doesn't mean that she's not going through something very, very serious and doesn't mean she's not working hard.
We're going to have to leave it right there. That's Michelle Lent Hirsch, her new book, Invisible, How Young Women with Serious Health Issues Navigate Work, Relationships, and the Pressure to Seem Just Fine. Michelle, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yesterday, we talked to the mayor of Edgerton, Kansas, about why he got an $89,000 pay raise. You can hear that conversation and others at kcur.org. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. And I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.